Well, fall seems to be in gear and winter is just around the corner, and that means our insect world is in full gear preparing for their winter. So we thought it a good time for another edition of What's Bugging You? Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. This program is made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director here at Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, at 800-552-8502. Again, that number to call in tonight, 800-552-8502. And Dr. Burden, glad to have you back with us again.
Well, it's my pleasure, Bill. Always want to come on and talk about insects. It's what I think about. It's what I do.
So I guess we'll get started. I mean, with the cold snap obviously on us tonight, and it feels pretty good out there to me after the brutal August. But, you know, once the cold weather kicks around, a lot of insects go into their natural hibernation cycle. Mm-hmm. But others, well, they kind of like to join us in our homes. They think that fireplace looks kind of warm and comfy, and the popcorn certainly smells good. So they'd like to come in and join us. What can we do and can we expect at this time of year?
Well, first, let's address the situation of what you can do. Insects and their other kind, like scorpions and spiders, can easily enter into houses through door jams, windows. And the big rule of thumb with that is if you can see light through a door, you know, the end of the bottom of a door or through a windowsill, if you can see light coming through, then the insects can come through as well. They can get into very, very small places. And so a little bit of weather stripping around the doors and the windows, not leaving the doors open and inviting them in that way, those are the best things. And then if it gets a little bit more severe, then we can talk about perimeter treating with certain types of non-noxious insecticides that might be a deterrent to them.
All right. And so, I mean, as we get prepared, what kind of insects might we look toward seeing coming to our house? Because there's a variety of different kinds, obviously.
Well, in order to answer that question, a lot of people need to realize that insects overwinter in various stages of development. There are some insects that overwinter as eggs, and they'll probably be down into the soil, around the grass line where there's an insulated layer, something that we oftentimes call leaf litter, between the actual dirt or the soil, if you will, and then the top of it. There are some insects that overwinter in a pupal stage, if they have pupal stages, and there's a lot of insects that overwinter in the adult stage. And the classic insect that overwinters in the adult stage that normally gives us problems all across the southeast, southwestern, and even up into the northern Great Plains are ladybugs. And that surprises a lot of people because everybody loves ladybugs until all of a sudden they have 200 or 300 coming into their house. Ladybugs have a very unique behavior, and they cue off certain signs dealing with weather, lunar cycles, and they're actually able to tell north from south, east and west, and they'll come into a house and they'll gather in one geographical point, say the southwest or the northwest. And most people don't want to kill the ladybugs because they know that the ladybugs are beneficial insects. And so what I would advise people to do if they have that problem, and it is quite common here in the Arklatex, is to have a little safe little vacuum and vacuum them up, or perhaps even just brush them up, put them in a brown paper bag, crumple up some paper and put in there so that they'll have little nooks and crannies to live in, and put it out in the garage, somewhere where you're not going to have a hard freeze, but it gets cold, because they need that cold exposure for a certain length of time for them to be happy in the spring. And then next spring, get out your bag ladybugs, sprinkle them around the yard in the garden, and they'll be there to be beneficials to eat the aphids and all the early spring pests that you may have to deal with.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about insects and the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have our first caller online, Corey from Ore City. Corey, go ahead with your call. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, it doesn't bug me per se. I generally don't have a problem with the insects and all. I try to teach my kids, leave them alone, they'll leave you alone. But I'm a crane operator, and things like this time of year, when we have our boom in the air, it's just there's wasps covering it. I mean, I looked up yesterday, and I bet there was 50 anyway, and they seem to be attracted to the grease that's in it. I was wondering if there was something in there that they used this time of year or what was going on with that.
That's not unusual in the insect world to find that a human-made substance may actually end up being an attractant for some of the insects. I've never particularly heard of perhaps industrial large machinery grease or lubricants that might be attracted to wasps, but wasps this time of year oftentimes release a pheromone, a chemical, that will cause the wasps to all come in into one area. We call that an aggregation pheromone, and it's highly possible that either is your equipment yellow?
Yes, it is.
They're attracted to yellow colors, especially this time of the year. And if they're attracted to other chemical cues, they will aggregate. And they just think that they're having an overwinter home. It's kind of like a sleepover for winter. And exactly like you said, that you tell your kids, don't bother them and they won't bother you. But if it is a pest with them getting in and out, I would just get me a long-handled brush and just shoo them away. But, you know, you don't want to anger them either, because even this time of the year, their ovipositors are full of venom and they can sting. So just be cautious with that. It's kind of interesting because a couple of weeks ago, I was showing a trick to some of my undergraduate students where if you have worker termites and you have a particular type of pen, and it's a papermate pen, there's something in the ink of that papermate pen that mimics a trail pheromone for the termites. So I can take a blank piece of paper, draw a letter B on it for Beverly Burden, release a couple termites down there, and they will trace the letter for you.
Really?
And it's amazing how close the human man-made material can sometimes mimic, because sometimes we're using natural sources, natural oils and such, and the two worlds can collide, but not in a bad way either.
Oh, yeah, and generally they're 30 to 100 feet above my cab, so we got some downtime. I just like to sit and watch them. And I think the grease, I believe, has a paraffin base to it, and that is not that sweet.
That would certainly, some of the oils, especially what we call the fatty acids that are in paraffins, can definitely mimic long-chain pheromone-type chemicals, absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Corey.
All right. Thank you, Corey. And you are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about bugs in the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. She is an associate professor of biology here at LSUS. And, of course, with us here at Red River Radio to take your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Give us a call and let us know what's bugging you. Now, at this time of year, we also have the potential for the earwigs to get up in your home and find refuge in other places as well. Can you tell us what is an earwig one and
sure.
Why do they like our homes?
Well, I happen to have quite a fondness for earwigs. They are elongate insects, approximately less than anywhere from a half to three quarters of an inch. They get smaller than that, but those ones you wouldn't notice. And they're actually akin to some of the cockroaches, but on their very end of their abdomen, they have a set of pincers, what we call forceps-like cerci, but they're pincers. And a lot of people will think that they're going to act like scorpions and grab you with those pincers, but they're not even strong enough to break the skin. So they're completely harmless, even though they want to look ferocious like a scorpion. But they like to crawl into tight spaces. So they'll come in at this time of the year and they'll crawl into tight spaces. And one of the biggest problems is when you start to bring in beautiful fall foliage, flowers from the rose garden or other type of fall foliage. They like to get down into the opening buds, and they will disrupt the formation of the petals. And then when the flower does open, the petals will be distorted, misshapen. And, of course, that takes away the aesthetic value of having a floral bouquet in your house. But they're absolutely harmless, and I would just shoo them outside and Not a concern at all.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You, the program about insects and our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burton. You can call us tonight at 800-552-8502. If you have questions or concerns about our insect world, she'll do her best to answer your questions. So far, I don't think we've ever stumped her. But we're going to work on that tonight, folks. And we have another caller online, Roger from Shreveport. You are online with Dr. Beverly Burton. What's bugging you tonight? Hello, Roger? Hello, Roger. Well, Jody, are you online then? Judy? All right. Well, we don't seem to have Roger there, so we're going to move on. We're going to go to Judy from Nacogdoches. Judy, what's bugging you tonight?
I have a problem with geckos. I don't know if the doctor can help me with that, but they're all over my house, and I don't know how they get in, but they're inside and outside.
One of the neat things about the geckos is they're one of the few invasive species, meaning that they're not native to this part of the world, that is coming in, and other than wanting to share perhaps your apartment or your house with you, they're absolutely not doing any harm to the natural environment. In fact, they're wall lizards, and we don't have any naturally occurring climbing wall lizards like that. And so they're not pushing out any of the native species of lizards, and they are eating bugs and insects. If they're trying to come into the house this time of the year, where they're just doing like we're all doing, we want to stay warm, they want to find a place to live. And I find that in the winter, I have a healthy population of them in my garage, and I just let them be because I know the next year that they're going to be there to take care of some of my insect pests. But they're infiltrating your home, your house, where you eat, sleep, watch TV and such. I would just catch them and put them back outside. But you should also then start checking, like we were talking about earlier in the show, checking around your doors and your windows to make sure that you have good winter seal weather stripping around them. And if they can't get through that, then they won't come into the house. So you have to use a physical barrier.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
And thank you for calling. You are listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burton, our resident entomologist here at Red River Radio and an associate professor of biology at LSUS. And we are taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I believe next up is Tommy from Carthage. Tommy?
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, normally around this time of year, people are getting pecans are about to come in, and this is the second time it's happened to me with some young pecan trees. It seems as if June bugs back in the summertime have just stripped the blooms off of the pecan trees, and I don't have any pecans that are about to come in, and I don't know if there's some natural way to build a barrier against these June bugs, or I'm not really interested in using a pesticide and spraying these trees or anything, but I'm just curious. This is the second time it's happened on these trees.
One of the biggest pests with pecan trees are things that are called the pecan weevil. And as the young buds are starting to open up, as you say, and the catkins, the male part of the flower, are starting to bloom, these weevils will get in and they will use their mouth parts to drill holes, and the pecans will become misshapen and misformed. And they're basically using these young developing pecans as a nursery. There's a lot of caterpillars out there that will get into the pecans, the case bearer caterpillars. There's the pecan aphid. Pecans have their own ecosystem going on. And what I would advise you to do, if you don't want to spray pesticides, well, the term pesticide has a lot of leeway. This time of the year, when everything is going dormant, you can spray what's called dormant oils. And they're not there to, since it's an oil, it's going to stick and it's not going to evaporate very much. And it will prevent another infestation in the spring. So you can't do anything that happened this year, but you can do an overwintering treatment with what we call insecticide oils, and most of your reputable nurseries will know what I'm talking about. and it causes absolutely no detrimental effect to the environment whatsoever. And that's a way that you can do natural yet protect next year's crop.
Does it need to be the entire tree or just so many feet up? Or?
Well, that's the problem with insects. They fly. A lot of the things that will lay eggs in the bark, you can treat the bark, but I would just give the tree an overall spray. And your nursery people can tell you, you know, how far up the tree, depending upon the age of the tree, you have to do things different.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, and thank you for calling What's Bugging You. This is our program about insects and our insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. Give us a call at 800-552-8502 and let us know what's bugging you tonight. We have Lily up next, and Randall, you are on hold. Please stay with us. Lily, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, I ride horses for leisure, and it seems the mosquitoes are bigger and badder than ever. Like this evening, they were horrible. And I'm wondering when they're going to go away or go dormant. And then second of all, someone told me Avon Skintosoft is a good repellent. And I just wondered if that's truth or myth or what your thoughts were.
Well, first of all, let's talk about your question about the mosquitoes. Until we have a good freeze, the mosquitoes are going to be a problem. I was outside doing some house management yesterday in the rain, and mosquitoes were all over me. So it was just, they love the humidity, and they are looking to lay that last clutch of eggs before winter actually comes. And the females must have a blood meal in order to lay that last clutch of eggs, because with most mosquitoes, as I was talking about earlier, they overwinter as eggs instead of adults. And so they're trying to get those last eggs in, and that's why they're so aggressive. Now, the skin's so soft, it will work to a degree, but only because it's covering up and it's masking your natural smell. They are releasing slowly, approved by the USDA, a new repellent to perhaps take over the DEET. But right now, the DEET repellent is the best way to go, and there's a lot of formulations with that. There's companies that have taken the DEET repellents, and they've been able to make them to where they're not, you know, overly repulsive. They're kind of a, you know, they don't smell so bad all the time. But it just depends on if you want to cover up your skin smells to repel so the mosquito can't find you, or you actually want to repel. And we talk, and I use repellent, and that's what I would suggest that you use too.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Lily, for calling in. And you are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. Call us tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with your calls about what's bugging you. Randall's up next, and Mike from Plain Dealing, you're on hold. Randall, what's bugging you tonight?
Stop cobwebs. I have a lot in my garage and some in the house.
When you were talking about cobwebs, I didn't get that first part. Could you repeat that again, please?
Yes, I have a lot of cobwebs in my garage, in the corners, around the light fixtures, all over my camping equipment. How do you stop that?
Well, in order to stop cobwebs, you're going to have to stop the spiders. And the places that you mentioned are the exact perfect habitat for spiders. In a garage, they don't like to be disturbed. And up in the corners, there's some spiders that like to do their webs exactly right in corners, or they'll choose any type of a nook or cranny that they can go into. And they're basically predators. All spiders, for the most part, are either predators or thieves. And there's some spiders that actually live in ant nests and steal the food from ants, but that's a different call. But you can, there are some very, very mild formulation sprays you can use to deter spiders, but you have to realize that once you kill the spiders, then you're going to maybe have a problem with all the critters that the spiders were eating. And so it's, do you want A or do you want B? And I would just routinely take a broom and brush up the cobwebs once a year, and it shouldn't be that much of a problem, except that, you know, there is a little bit of of an aesthetic problem. People don't like cobwebs all over their stuff. But again, as some of the people would say, it's harmless. What did they do to you? You know, they're just out there living their life as you do in your. But if you don't like them, spray maybe something with a malathion or a carbaryl. You're probably familiar with seven dust, and that would work as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for calling What's Bugging You. This is our program about entomology with Dr. Beverly Burden, our resident entomologist here. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And let us know what's bugging you. And I believe we have Mike from Plain Dealing. Mike, you're on the line. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, I am deathly allergic to wasps, and I've watched them throughout my whole life, and I'm just trying to understand what purpose they serve in the ecology.
Sure. Wasps, for the most part, are predators. And one of my favorite wasps are the things that are called dirt daubers, because they will, they're just so industrial. They basically go after spiders, and each dirt dauber will choose a particular species of spider. And these are the ones that build the organ pipe type butt dirt nest, or they'll have a little round circular dirt nest. And they basically provision these with spiders and lay their eggs in there so their young can basically eat the spiders alive. But if you're talking about the yellow jackets and other type of paper wasps, they are predators and they are eating a lot of caterpillars out there in the environment. So it's the old, we don't like to use the word food chain anymore. We like to use the word food web, because there's a lot of different types of interactions. We do consider them to be beneficial, but if you're allergic, then there's a lot of ways. Just be watching in the house when they start to even build a nest, even when it's just a few cells big. You know, take it down and let them know that they're not welcome there, and you just have to be very diligent in keeping track of where they are and stay away from those areas, or knock them out of those areas by using a very strong pesticide. Maybe those things that kind of shoot 27 feet in the air, that could be one of your options.
Well, sure, I understand that, but I've had several encounters since I've been diagnosed as allergic to them, where they will fly directly into my car or fly directly into my face. And I'm just wondering.
As I said earlier, there's a lot of wasps that are attracted to the yellow color or to the color yellow. And if they're being attracted to you, you might want to actually switch colognes or to somehow squelch your natural body odors. Not that, you know, that you're attracting them through your body odors, but they're coming in, and it might just be, you know, happenstance. You know, I run into wasps a lot, and it's not because I want to run into them. They're just there. They're out hunting, and they just get lost.
All right. I want to thank you for your call. You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about entomology with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. If you have a call about or a question about insects and our insect world, you can call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have Tom from East Texas online. Tom, what's bugging you tonight?
Good evening. I just bought a place, 28 acres, and when I shredded the weeds off of it, there was 10 million grasshoppers. Grasshoppers ate everything that I planted for a garden. Next year, what can I do to keep the grasshoppers at bay?
Sure, Tom. That's a really great question. I'm actually glad this came up tonight, because it is this time of the year that grasshoppers are laying their eggs. And grasshoppers lay their eggs, the female grasshopper, of course, does. She lays their eggs in a little tube, a little canal that she has formed into the soil. If they were devastating to your garden, the best thing you can do this year is to take a rototiller, or depending on how big your garden is, perhaps even a tractor tiller, and till the earth up, because that's going to dig up the eggs and expose them to the cooler temperatures and to the frost, and they will not, and it'll basically, Mother Nature will kill them. Now, every once in a while, we will have these massive explosions of grasshoppers, and some of them are the large black and red grasshoppers that we call the lubber grasshoppers, and a lot of people think that they're foreign to our area, but we just don't see them very often. And ironically, and I like to put this out every time I talk about grasshoppers, the term locust means migratory grasshopper. Here in the Southeast, where most of us were raised, we call locusts those things that are up in the trees this time of the year singing. Actually, those around the world and around the United States are called cicadas. So if you're going to use the word locust correctly, it stands for these large migratory grasshoppers that sometimes build up in large numbers. And it really depends on the exact species. We don't have grasshopper swarms like we used to have in this country, especially during the Dust Bowl days. But you never know when it's going to turn around and come back into happening again.
Would chickens tilt the soil enough to take care of the grasshoppers?
No, I don't think they would, because they're surface feeders. You know, and even though they might scratch around, they're only going to scratch around the surface, you know, to upturn a lot of the grains, a lot of the seeds. But if you can dig them up and, you know, and expose the eggs, and then the chickens go out, then they would have a wonderful buffet of grasshopper omelets.
You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we did have somebody called in and left the question here. John asked about mature pecan trees. He wants to know how to get rid of twig girdlers, I guess it is.
Man.
And he's tried, they're still typing. He's tried burning the branches, they need to type faster in there.
Well, let me just tell what people what twig girdlers are.
Yeah, please do.
One of the reasons that I got into the study of insects is to try to learn as much as I could about them in order to, you know, discourage the kind that eats our vegetables and our fruits and the nuts that are produced on trees. And I come from Texas, where we produce a lot of pecan trees, just like we do here in the Ark-La-Tex. Now, plants are master biochemists. Many, many plants can produce their own insecticides, but they only do so in response to sensing a stress. There's a believe it or not, plants get stressed out, and they have a stress hormone that's called ethylene. And when ethylene is produced, that can turn on chemicals being produced. And these chemicals are basically produced down at the base of the tree. And so they have to use the tree's circulatory system, something that we call xylem and phloem, to send the poisons up into the branches, up into the twigs, where the insects are feeding. Twig girdlers are smart. What they do is they pick out a branch that they want to feed on, but before they start feeding and causing the plant to experience some type of a stress, they will go down and they will chew away the bark. It's basically like cutting off a pipeline and severing, you know, arteries and veins, and so the liquids can't reach and the insecticides can't reach that particular branch. And once they've severed the pipeline for the insecticides to come into that branch, then they can go and feed. Plant girdlers can come in a wide variety of plant families. A lot of them are in just the plant feeding beetles. And so I would again suggest possibly an essential oil over the winter. But at the same time, I would also encourage John to go out and take a really good observational tour up and down his pecan tree and find out if there's any holes in there that can't be contributed to woodpeckers, and these might be caused by some of the wood boring beetles that may be basically encouraging these twig girdlers to come about. If they have holes, and then there's certain types of gas treatments they can do. It's a hard situation.
Yeah. You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about bugs, the insect world, with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can call us up at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with your question or concern about our insect world. Steve and Sasha, you are on a hold right now, but Maggie is up next. Please stay with us. And Maggie, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, we've just painted our house. They have a house that's over 100 years old, and we're getting advice to paint the porch ceilings blue to keep wasps and things from nesting, that they think it's a sky. Is that a true thing, or is this an old wives' tale, or what?
It isn't a wives' tale. Insects see color completely different than what we see color. Like I said, there are some colors that will be more attractive to, say, wasp, and that's yellow. But insects basically see in the ultraviolet range, and especially insects that might be attracted to flowers. But it's a myth. I would paint my porch any color I would want to paint my porch, and just enjoy your 100-year home. I'm sure it's beautiful, Maggie.
Well, thank you. All right, thank you very much.
All right,
you're welcome.
Thank you, Maggie, for calling in. And if you have a question or concern about our insect world, you can call us right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. The name of the program is What's Bugging You? And our resident entomologist is Dr. Beverly Burton. And we got Steve next from Bernice. Steve, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, I was going to ask about something else, but you've been talking about pecan trees. I have seen some dead limbs fall out of some pecan trees around an old house place, and they had bugs that had an iridescent green color on their backs, and they were, like to say, about 3/4 of an inch long. Are those the bugs you were talking about?
It could be. Let me tell you what you're describing. And there are two different types of beetles that will bore into pecan trees. And those are the round-headed, and those are the, not round-headed, but the oblong, oval type of a bore into the pecan trees. And you can look at their exit holes. What happens is the adults will come along, and they will lay eggs at the base of the tree. The eggs will hatch, and the larvae will penetrate the bark, and they will bore into the bark until they get ready to come out as an adult, and then they will bore another hole out to come out. And some are the round-headed, and some are the oblong. Now, the oblong is what you described, because if the adults are iridescent, what we call a metallic green, a metallic blue, even sometimes a metallic black, those are going to be the oblong wood hort, oblong head borer beetles. That's a little bit difficult to say. And again, about the, you cannot spray because they're inside the wood. And so the best thing you can do is try to prevent the eggs from happening next year, and that's where your essential oils come in.
All my life I've heard about invasive Japanese beetles.
Yep.
Is that what that is, or what?
No, if they're short, it depends on. If they're short and oblong, they're the boring beetles. If they look like a large green June bug, then those are the Japanese beetles. And the Japanese beetles are very iridescent green as well, but you would probably not find them very much on a pecan tree. They like more the ornamental plants, especially roses. And for the Japanese beetle, if you don't want to use a real strong pesticide, what they have on the market right now are fungal spores that are very aggressive, and you can spray your plant with the fungal spores, and the insects, especially these beetles, these scarab-like beetles, just like June bugs, will come along and eat it. And then once they are infested internally with the spore, it will basically eat them from the inside out. We should have done this on Halloween, because it's a very gruesome death. All of a sudden, you'll just find this beetle with this fungus growing out of its body, and it's a white fungus, and so it's very, very showy.
All right. We want to thank you for your call, and you are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. We have a full lineup right now, but you can still call in 800-552-8502. We have Joyce and John are on hold right now, along with Arthur, but Sasha from Dallas, you are online right now. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi. Well, I'm really glad to be on the air. I just love bugs. I'm a veterinarian. And I have a couple questions. One, I heard on NPR there was a book about the internal, parasitic worms, but they're finding out now that they're kind of beneficial. And I just didn't know if you remembered that book name or if you've heard of it, because I don't know the name and I want to read it. So that's one. The other thing is the kind of cockroaches that, that come into your house when you're leaving crumbs out versus the kind that, like, the water bugs. I want to know kind of the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because when my boyfriend sees the water bug, he freaks out. And I don't think that they're the same. And so I want to have some information about that.
Sure. Let me first say something about the book that you talked about. I'm not familiar with that. But they are discovering that some internal parasites can actually be a little bit more beneficial, especially in controlling or giving some type of immunity from some of the very primitive type of ailments. And so in the past, in our evolutionary history, and that would include dogs and cats as well, if they had the parasites, that would help them actually be resistant to something worse. And there's a lot of interest in that in both veterinary medicine and in human medicine. And it's pretty controversy, I have to say, because nobody likes to talk about good parasites versus bad parasites, but that is where some of the research is carrying us. And depending on which NPR program you listen to, they have great websites and they have great archives. That's one of the beautiful things about public radio, is if you hear it once, you can go back and do your research and find out about it again. And Bill may know more about that as a program director. But now let me talk about your cockroaches. I tell my students that cockroaches basically come in three sizes, small, medium, and large. And there's thousands of species of cockroaches worldwide. There's 100 or more species of cockroaches in the United States. But there's only two or three species of cockroaches that, and I teasingly say, that will lower themselves to live with humankind. And the water bug that you mentioned is called the Oriental cockroach, and it does like to live in moist tropical places. Bill has spent a lot of time, the director here, in Florida, and down in Florida, they call the water bugs palmetto bugs.
Yes.
But they are cockroaches. But the reason they don't look like the typical cockroach is because they don't have developed wings. And so people tend to call them palmetto bugs or water bugs, but they're still cockroaches. And they are feeding on some type of a natural organic material, or else you wouldn't have them in their house, except for the fact that they just might be coming in for the moisture. Now, the kind that you would have in the kitchen would be either the small or the large. And the small are the German cockroaches, very hard to get rid of. You can tell that they're German cockroaches because they work kind of like a hoodie, and on the hood above their head will have two brown stripes. Or if you have the larger ones, that's probably the American cockroach. Cockroaches, no matter what, use boric acid. It's completely safe for pets, humans, and it has directions on the bottle on how to use it, boric acid.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. And I used to have this book called The Tiny Game Hunter, and I really just like the way that you look for the least toxic way to do it. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and thanks for your call, Sasha.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You on Red River Radio, our program about the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. She's an associate professor of biology here at LSUS and our resident entomologist at Red River Radio. We have Joyce, John, and Stuart on hold right now, but Arthur from Goldsport, Mississippi, you are next. What's bugging you? Hello,
yes,
Arthur.
I'm trying to figure out. Hello?
Go ahead, Arthur.
Okay. Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to figure out what it takes to get rid of ants. Seems like you kill one dead or nothing crop up.
Excellent question. And that's something that I really appreciate you asking, because a lot of people don't understand that. Now, what happens is you may have one, and I'm going to basically customize this to fire ants, because that's what most people are concerned about. You'll have a large mound of fire ants. And that's easy to see in your yard or in a field. But what you're not seeing, Arthur, is the fact that there are smaller colonies of ants around that large colony. But the large colony suppresses the smaller colonies. And so if you use a really good insecticide, and I especially like companies that use the chemical acephate, it's a organophosphate chemical, and it's very good at treating fire ant mounds. If you kill that main mound, then what happens is some of those mounds that were being suppressed are now free from suppression, and their mounds will build up. And it looks like, you know, if you kill one, another one pops up, but if they're not moving. It's just that if you kill the big mound, then the little mounds can come and get into their own power struggle as well. And if you just keep treating then eventually you should be able to control the fire ants in your yard. There's also baits that are out there. If you don't want to do a mound treatment, there are perimeter baits that you can do as well. Just go to the store, read up on them, and they'll say baits on there.
If you don't want to do a mound treatment, there are perimeter baits that you can do as well. Just go to the store, read up on them, and
okay.
What I would do is do both. And there's a great scientist over at Texas A&M, Bart Dries, and he says if you do both the bait and the mound treatment, then that's like doing the Texas two-step. You hit them one, two, and they're gone.
Texas A&M, Bart Dries.
Yeah. Right. He's an excellent source if you can find his name.
That's like doing the Texas two-step. You hit them one, two, and they're gone.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, we're gonna move on now. I want to thank you very much for your call. And you are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, our program about the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have John from Houston calling back. John, what's bugging you again?
Hey, thank you. This is an interesting program. You know, Houston's the cockroach capital, I think, of the world. But I'm calling about bed bugs.
Ah.
I've got an apartment building. One guy's getting eaten up. I don't know if it's his own personal hygiene or if I've got a problem, but can you see him or how can you treat him?
All right, John. Love that question. I was hoping we would get a bed bug question in tonight. Let's start with the basics. What are they? And then let's talk a little bit about their biology and what you can do about them. First of all, bed bugs are small. They're basically shaped and colored very much like an apple seed. So they're very small, they're very brown, they're about the same size, shape, and color of an apple seed. And what you need to do is you need to look on all of the bed, up in the box springs. They like to hide in crevices. And they will hide during the day, and then they will come out at night and take blood meals. And depending on the temperature, one female can live for 30 days without having another blood meal. And so you have to be very diligent. You have to look on, behind the baseboards if you have paper covering the walls, as you know, decorative wallpaper. Then if it peels back a little bit, they'll be up underneath that. They'll also leave brown little spots on the sheets and on the mattress to where you can tell that there's a major bed bug problem. And there, you can't go in there and spray somebody's bed with an insecticide. That's just not done. And there are basically two treatments. One is heat. There's some situations where you can close off the whole apartment, apply a lot of heat, or if it's just isolated to the bed, put it in cold storage. And I know that's real expensive, and it's not very, you know, one, two, three, we're done type of a thing. But the good thing about bed bugs, and nobody want to hear this, but they're not known to transmit any diseases like mosquitoes do. So I guess if I had to be bit by something, I would rather be bit by a bed bug. But on the other hand, you can't distinguish bed bug bites from flea bites. So if your tenant has a lot of dogs in there, then that could be a problem too. The best thing to do is to observe, collect the specimens, and get them to an entomologist for a definitive identification, and it's not that hard. You've seen one bed bug, you've seen them all.
Yeah, he has red spots on him, and he's assuming it's bed bugs. That's what I'm telling him. It could be anything else.
Unless you have visual proof that the bed bugs are there, and or they catch the specimens, and you can look at them, and if they are, you know, look like a little apple seed, then yeah, you probably have bed bugs because that's the only thing that's going to look like that, that's going to bite and leave those little dots all over the body. But you better make sure it's not fleas as well.
All right. I want to thank you for calling, and you're listening to What's Bugging You, our program about entomology with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can call us tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Joyce, Shree, and Steve, you are all on deck. Stuart, you are up next from Longview. Stuart, what's bugging you tonight?
Yeah, so for my line of work, I climb communications towers.
Yeah.
They're made of galvanized metal, and they have radio equipment that's broadcasting high frequencies. And I notice that there are wasps that, hang around the tower. They fly around there. And of course, it makes me nervous. Now, I'm, you know, tethered to the tower. So if one were to bite me and I were to react by letting go, I'm, heaven forbid, I would be safe. But they never bite me. They never bug me. I guess that's, I wanted to get your thoughts about what it is they like about the communications tower, or, and what might be a reason that they never seem to bite me.
Well, first of all, wasps don't bite. They sting. And you have to get on the other end of the insect. And it's only the females that sting because they have a modified egg-laying apparatus that now is attached to a venom sac. And most wasps are not aggressive. In order for them to actually be attracted to somebody, they have to be attracted to a smell or they have to be attracted to a color. I have been out in a field where there has wasps all around, and I just stand there, and they will come along, and they will investigate, you know, legs, arms, torso, and they're looking for something to eat. They're looking for caterpillars or other little bugs to eat, and having not found any, then they move away. So they're not aggressive. Leave them alone. And one of the reasons that a lot of wasps are attracted to human-made structures like that is because there's all kinds of angles, pipe angles, and other areas that it's safe to build a nest in. And they're way up off the ground. The fire ants aren't going to get to them. And it's just a safe place to live. A lot of people live in high-rises. Wasps do too. And so just leave them alone and you'll be fine. And I doubt if they're going to just really seek you out to sting you. But if so, then you might want to wear some DEET. DEET is oftentimes only thought about being a repellent for mosquitoes, but DEET can also repel other insects as well.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight, 800-552-8502, with your questions or concerns. And Joyce, we have you online next. Joyce, what's bugging you tonight?
Earlier, a guy called in about the grasshoppers eating his garden up, and I have a brother that lives in Kaufman, and he planted peas, and the grasshoppers just ate them up. And she said earlier to till it up. He does that every year, but still. There's just swarms of them, thousands of them. What else can he do to take care of them?
Well, you know, grasshoppers are very, very tough insects to deal with. They're resistant to a lot of the insecticides. They're just like the little bullies of the insect world. And so if it was my garden and the tilling to reduce the numbers over the spring isn't working, It sounds to me like he's probably not in a very urban area. He's probably in a very rural area where there's a lot of other natural pasture land and forest around there that will support the overwintering grasshoppers. And so the next best thing for him to do is to go to some of the classical insecticides. Now, earlier I talked about malathion and I talked about seven, but one of the ones that I would suggest that your brother use is the natural perithrins. There's a lot of chemistry difference between that, but let me just say this to keep it, at an educational level. If you go to the store and if you find a bottle that says this will kill garden pest, then look at the very, very, very fine print and look at what it says, active ingredient. And whatever fancy scientific name is there, if it ends in the letters THRIN, the suffix THRIN, then it's going to be a pyrethrin, and that's going to be a safer insecticide to spray around the garden. And that's the first thing I would hit them with. And hit them early, because if you wait until they build up so far in numbers, then you're not going to be, they're just going to overpower you.
You are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, our program about our insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. Call us up tonight with your question at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Steve on call right now and then Bill after that. But right now, Shree from Houghton, you are on the line. What's bugging you tonight?
Hi.
Hi.
I was listening to the gentleman earlier who actually was a woman who had called in about roaches.
Uh-huh.
And you had said they're small, medium, and large.
Yep.
And the large ones are water bugs, and they don't have developed wings. Do they still fly sometimes?
Actually, it's the medium size that are the water bugs, and you can look them up. Not so much as water bugs, but in the scientific community, you'll be likely to find them as oriental cockroaches. And no, ma'am, they do not fly. Their wings will not support their body weight and their body shape. But the other cockroaches that do have wings do fly. And that really disturbs a lot of people, knowing that there's flying cockroaches out there. But if they're in your house, then there's no reason for them to fly anywhere. They're looking for something to eat. And if you don't give them anything to eat, then they're not going to live and they're not going to, you know, keep coming into your house. On the other side, though, people don't realize how efficient the digestive system of cockroaches are. Cockroaches have been known to, and this is going to gross some people out, but cockroaches have been known to be kept alive on nothing but toenail clippings for a year, because toenail clippings are protein, they're keratin. And so to them, that's like a big, you know, hunk of meat. And so you just vacuuming, cleaning, and a lot of people get cockroaches and they have a perfectly clean house forever, but they're allowing the cockroaches to get in because they're not putting any physical barriers around their doors or around their windows. You know, a lot of people ask me, Dr. Burden, when are the insects going to take over the world? And my answer is they already have.
Yeah,
and they're just barely letting us coexist with them.
Couple of billion years ago, it seems
yeah.
like so. All right, we have an unknown caller online right now. No, we do not have an unknown caller online right now. We have a hang up online right now. And we're going to go to our next caller. And I believe that this is Steve from Bernice. Steve, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, a couple of things. When I was in school, y'all were talking about mosquitoes earlier. When I was in school, when I was a young kid, they taught us that the Panama Canal, they had trouble building it because of Anopheles mosquitoes, and they stand on their heads.
Yep.
Well, over around Shreveport, y'all got a lot of mosquitoes that stand on their heads. They're a big swamp mosquito. Are they Anopheles mosquitoes?
Yes, they are. And that's a great thing that I love to talk about. If I didn't know better, I planted you out there as a as someone to call in and ask me specifically that question. Actually, Anopheles mosquitoes are more akin to malaria. There's three different types of species. You have the scientific names of Aedes, Anopheles, and Culex. It's actually the Aedes mosquitoes that were transmitting yellow fever back in the 1890s when we were building the Panama Canal. And let me just share a little bit of a history lesson with you there. When we were building the Panama Canal, it was the Army that was doing so, and they would send troops down there, and they would get yellow fever and die, and this went on and on and on, until finally they sent Walter Reed and his entourage down there. He was an Army surgeon, and Walter Reed was the one that discovered, hey, it may be something to do with the mosquitoes. So he let half of his people get bit by mosquitoes, and half of his people not to get bit by mosquitoes. And the people that got bit by mosquitoes caught yellow fever and died. And this was the absolute very first time in medical history that a disease was linked to a mosquito bite or to a tick bite or to any kind of arthropod bite. And then they started looking around and realizing that there was a lot of diseases that were the cause of bites. And what's fascinating about this, Steve, is that was only like 120 years ago. And so in medical history, it's phenomenal. Now, Anopheles do malaria, Culex do encephalitis, and we have all three of those in the ocular ticks. But it depends on the species. And that's a whole nother rigmarole. Not all mosquitoes can transmit all diseases.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You, your program about entomology here with Dr. Beverly Burden, our resident entomologist. She's an associate professor of biology at LSUS, and she stops over here to help us out with our questions about the insect world during these call-in programs. We have time for one or two more callers. You can call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Dolores from Gilmer online right now. Dolores, what's bugging you?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. It's not what's bugging me, it's what's bugging my cat. I'm always on the lookout for natural treatments to treat fleas. I've retired. I'm on a fixed income and don't have the expendable resources as I did before. So I'm looking for natural ways to take care of the fleas for the cats, especially now that winter's here and they'll be inside most of the time. And so what do you suggest?
Number one, you need to find out where the immature fleas are living. Immature fleas are kind of like a little grub or a little caterpillar, like before they turn into an adult flea. And if you find that they're living in the cat bedding and in the blankets that they like to sleep in, anywhere the cats like to spend a long amount of time, if it was a dog, I'd say look in the doghouse. And you can take and just hygienically clean and wash that area, maybe spray it with some bleach or some pine salt to discourage those. If you take care of the immatures, you're going to prevent them from hatching into adults. And so that's the number one thing. The other thing is make sure that you have good hygiene habits, good grooming habits for your cats. A well-groomed cat is not going to have as many of a flea population as an ungroomed cat. And so those things cost hardly any money at all. And that's the first place I would start, and just keep vacuuming, and you'll get on top of it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right. And we have time for one more call. We're going to get this in quick. Steve from Bernice is back online. Steve, what's bugging you again?
About the fleas, my daddy always put out lines. But what's really bugging me is I wanted to ask her one more time, has she learned anything about catawpa worms and how to make them grow?
Oh, boy, if I had the secret to growing catawpa worms, Steve, you and I would both be rich. The only way to have catawpa worms is to have catawpa trees. And the only way to have catawpa worms on the catawpa trees is not to use a lot of pesticides and make sure that they're very good, healthy trees so the catawpa worms don't kill them. And as far as fleas and lime, salt will work too. Anything that will cause them to be dehydrated will take care of the fleas as well. So salt treatment and lime.
Lime in the house, you got that, but out in the barn or a dog kennel, you can use it.
You can use it. So in the house, I would get me some rock salt and treat some of the areas, and that way you can kind of compare the treatments outside and inside. We can do a little experiment right here on the radio.
But I've only recently found out that catawpa trees are kind of like a sweet gum or something. You can actually root it from a bud on the limb.
Yeah, most trees can be grafted that way. And so, you know, grow you a catawpa orchard so you can get a lot of catawpa worms and set up your own bait and tackle shop right there in Bernice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. I want to thank you for calling and thank everybody for calling in tonight. We did have one online question, and it's very quick.
All right.
They say quick grits. Yep. Can you get rid of ants that way?
No, there's a lot of, old wives' tales and myths about that. The theory behind that is that the ants will eat the grits, and then once the grits get in the stomach, it'll absorb the moisture of the body of the ant. It'll swell up and kill the ant. They've done studies on that. It doesn't work. There's been quick grits and all kinds of things, and the only thing that really, really works is the bait and the acephate treatments.
All right. You've been listening to Dr. Beverly Burden, Associate Professor of Biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. We'd like to thank everybody for calling tonight. This program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And if you would like to find out more about what's bugging you, you can contact us at Red River Radio at 800-552-8502. What's Bugging You is produced by Bill Beckett with assistance from Wally Derleth and Daniel Gordy. Thanks, everybody, for calling tonight, and have a good evening.